Just to put you at ease, we're not jumping ahead to the New Testament this morning. We are going to be doing Joshua 17 through 19. But as Tucker said, sometimes the chapters that you're presented with don't necessarily warrant themselves to a great scripture intro. So we did what we did because it applies. So what I want to ask you is have any of you been the recipient of one of those gifts where immediately after opening it, you know you're not going to use it, right? It might be because you're allergic to scented candles, or you've already got a cupboard full of coffee mugs, right? Or that singing trout, you know, a little too tacky for my den or my office. And that fruit cake? Are you kidding me? Come on, it's a fruit cake. Somebody like, all right. Who likes fruitcake? So we want to laugh at you. You and you. I just probably had to always get bad fruitcakes or something. Mine are regifted. You know, you say, oh, that's such a lovely gift. But right as after you open it, you're already trying to figure out, what am I going to do with this thing? You know, what closet am I going to put it into? Can I regift it? Can I bring it back? But all right, so here's another example. What about a time where someone gave you a gift, but instead of opening it immediately, right there as they were hoping that you would, you decided to leave it wrapped up because you were afraid of what was inside, maybe, or perhaps you just weren't feeling festive enough at the time. Probably not very likely. Normally, you open them. What about a time where you never bothered to open the gift at all? That'd be pretty rude, wouldn't it? Have you ever asked for a specific gift, maybe because a friend had one or you saw it on TV or the internet, but after trying that thing out, you realize, I don't have the skill, the time, the energy for this thing. I'm not going to be using it. You know, things like a laptop or maybe a cell phone or a musical instrument, exercise equipment, you know, those are the things that come into mind there. Joshua chapters 13 through 19, so the chapters that Tucker talked about last week, as well as the ones I'm going to talk about today, it's about a process where the different tribes of the Israelites receive a gift. In their case, it's land. And what we're going to do today is I'm going to go back and I'm going to review a little bit of what Tucker said, and we're going to go through there's a chart on one half of your, or one side of your page. We're going to talk about the tribes that Tucker did real briefly, and then we'll get into more detail in the ones from chapters 17 through 19. So the first part of Joshua, chapters 1 through 12, we learned about the initial entry into the promised land itself. Now the promised land in total was about 56,000 square miles big. In fact, Jim, why don't you go ahead and put that map up there. So the promised land is about 56,000 square miles. It's about, you know, about the size of Iowa. I picked Iowa because you guys would get a kick out of that, right? So you know how big the promised land was. Now, when they went in there, they didn't eliminate every people group, okay? So what they did, they attacked certain areas of the promised land. They had a base camp, we'll call it, Gilgal. I'm not sure if Gilgal is on there. It's somewhere in the middle in... Maybe that's it. Maybe I put the blue star there to represent Gilgal. So that was their base camp. And then we've learned that what they did, so, you know, they came up this way, crossed the Jordan. So they did fighting in this area, in central. And then they went down to the south, did battles down here. And then they went back up to the north and did battles up there. And then they've kind of come back to the middle area. So these weren't, you know, it's a big area, so they couldn't just get in one line and walk through and take the entire promised land. They did little battles here and there. So once they had these key areas taken, then what was going to happen is this land is going to be sectioned off into 13 different territories. The ones in red are the ones that Tucker spoke about last week. So these different tracts of land each came with different resources. Some had more hills, some had more pasture and whatnot. That's what the colors, I think, on the map try to represent. Each different land was going to have certain benefits, certain challenges, certain kind of enemies. But the key was that each individual tribe then had the opportunity to decide, am I going to take hold of this promise and conquer that land. So we learned that the process for giving out these lands involved lots. Okay. So the lots seems like, if you read the entire lot or land allotment process, it seems like the lots not only determine the sequence that the tribes got their land, but also which specific areas they got. Doesn't tell us all the nitty-gritty details. But it's interesting, as we look at the lot assignment, it's not just the drawing of lots that determines who gets what and how much they get. It seems that the distribution of the land also took into consideration special requests. Because remember, the original promised land was supposed to be here on this side. But when the Israelites came up on this side of the Jordan River, Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh, they said, no, this land looks pretty good right here. We're going to take this. So that was an example of special request. And then another example of how the lands were allotted had to do with previously promised land. So that we learned about that with Caleb in the tribe of Judah last week. The assignment process had to do with what their best guess was for how the lands should be apportioned, right? They didn't have modern surveying techniques. They didn't have a plane or a drone that they could fly over this land to figure out what the boundaries should be exactly. So it was based upon ancient surveying capabilities, and it also then was based upon the size of the tribes that were handing the land out to. So on one hand, it's a process ordained by God, but on the other hand, it wasn't a perfect science either, because man had to get involved and determine how to hand the land out. So once the land was allotted, all these different tribes, it was each tribe's responsibility to finish the job, conquer their territory. And I want to read real briefly what it says in Numbers. This is what God said to Moses. Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into Canaan, drive out the inhabitants of the land, destroy carved images, cast idols, demolish your high places, take possession of the land and settle in it, for I have given you the land to possess. Distribute the land by lot, distribute it according to their ancestral tribes. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, those you allow to remain will become barbs in your eyes and thorns on your sides. They will give you trouble in the land where you live. And then I'm going to do to you what I said I would do to them. So you can see the different lands. We're going to focus, again, real shortly on the ones in the red triangle, or triangles, red, the rectangles, right? Thank you. In the red rectangles, and then we're going to get to the other areas. And as you would expect, as with any people group, once you hand out responsibilities, there's going to be different ways that people respond to what they're given to do. So Joshua 13. We've got Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. They settled for land on the east side of the Jordan River. So when you're writing there on your paper, I think I've got a category. So what was their attitude or something to that effect? I think that they settled for less than what God had originally planned for them, because the promised land he described was on the west side of the Jordan. But they saw this land as they were walking through it, and it looked good to them. So they said, hey, Moses, we want this land. So they settled for that land. Here's their performance. This is in Joshua 13. But the Israelites did not drive out the people of the East Manasseh area. So they continued to live among the Israelites to that day. So they didn't fare well. There were still enemies that they couldn't defeat. In fact, history tells us, and the Bible tells us, that 600 years later, these people, they're more vulnerable to the enemy. They get carried away. They get carried away by the Assyrians about 600 years after what we're talking about here today. Joshua 14, they got into the process of assigning the land on the west side of the Jordan River. And that's where we talked about Caleb and the tribe of Judah. And it seems, based upon the way Joshua 14 unfolded, that those people were proactive or eager in their desire to receive their allotment. And if you focus specifically on what Caleb did, his performance was pretty successful. I mean, he went in and he improved the land, and he conquered like he and Joshua had said the people were supposed to do. But if you look at the tribe of Judah as a whole, in Joshua 15, they could not dislodge the enemy from their land completely. In fact, if you look ahead to the book of Judges, it says they took possession of the hill country, but were unable to drive out the people from the plains because the enemy there had chariots fitted with iron. So we've got Reuben, Gad, the half-tribe of Manasseh, we've got Caleb, we've got the Judah people all on your sheet now. So now we move ahead to Joshua 16. This is still review. We got to the tribe of Joseph. Actually, we learned, remember, that Joseph was going to be split up among Manasseh and then Ephraim because of the blessing that was bestowed upon that line of the family. So they're going to end up with two areas. Tucker described how, so here, is East Manasseh, so this is half of the tribe of Manasseh. The other half is going to be here, and then here is Ephraim. So all this area. So we can see they got a big area. They were proactive, is what we heard last week. But besides the East Manasseh folks who I said who settled for land, the West Manassites and the tribe of Ephraim did seem proactive. But here again, they had similar results as Judah. The Bible says in Joshua 16:10, and then it says again in Judges, nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer. But the Canaanites continued to live there among them. So you can see some attitudes and some performance from the chapters that Tucker did. So now we get to Joshua chapter 17. We're going to pick up and talk about the remaining tribes. So first, Manasseh. So we're going to talk about today the West Manassites. Okay, so these guys, the other half of the tribe of Manasseh. Joshua 17, verse 1. It starts out and it's a reminder that, yeah, we're going to be talking about Manasseh, but remember that the East Manassites, they had already received their land over here. So that's Joshua chapter 17, verse 1. It says they've already received their land, so now we're going to get to verse 2, West Manasseh. So the family tree is kind of interesting here with West Manasseh, verses 2 through 8, or 2 through 6. It helps to know a little bit of the background. So here's how the family tree of Manasseh goes. So Jacob's firstborn son was Joseph. Joseph's firstborn son was Manasseh. Manasseh's firstborn son was Machir. Machir had a son named Gilead. Okay, so we're down a few levels of the family tree. Gilead had a total of 6 sons. 5 of the clans named after the sons of Gilead received an allotment. Okay, and there were 5 of these guys. And I think they're named in the verses there, so I won't name them now. The 6th son, a guy named Hefer, was a special case. He had a son named Zelophehad who only had daughters. Okay, so you got some guys here that are receiving land. The names of the 5 daughters are Mahla, Noah, Hagla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And I name them because we're going to talk about them more specifically. So here's Joshua 17:2. The allotment for the rest of the people of Manasseh talks about the clans again, those sons. Ebezer, Helek, Azrael, Shechem, Hefer, and Shemida. These are the other male descendants of Manasseh. Now Zelophehad, son of Hefer, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons but only daughters. And then he names them again, just like I did. These people went to Eleazar the priest. You might want to underline that. They went to Eleazar the priest. They went to Joshua, son of Nun, and the leaders, and said, "The Lord commanded Moses to give us an inheritance among our relatives." So Joshua gave them inheritance with the brothers of their father, according to the Lord's command. Manasseh ends up getting 10 tracts of land, 5 for the sons, and 5 more for the daughters. And he reminds us that that's why they got 10, because of that breakdown there. So we learn that the West Manasseh half-tribe was proactive and received 10 tracts of land. But I want to spend just a little bit of time here talking about these daughters because they're drawn out. And in fact, this is the third time they're mentioned in the Bible. The first time is in Numbers 27, even before, just before God told Moses that Joshua was going to be the new leader, long before any territory was even handed out, people knew that portions were going to be handed out. They just didn't know exactly how it was going to go down. Their father had died without sons. Way back then, they appealed to Moses, and they requested that his inheritance of their father be passed on to the daughters. In the Israelite tradition, the sons were normally the ones that would get the land. So they wanted to see if they could, you know, take that land for themselves. And what ended up happening is the property laws of the nation were changed, and that did occur. So in cases when daughters were going to kind of be on the outside looking in, as far as inheritance go, they were going to be taken care of. The second time you get to these women, it was in Numbers 36, so a little bit later. Again, these verses are before any land is handed out. The land hasn't been decided. The leaders of Manasseh, knowing what had been decided for these women, they came to the leaders of Israel as a whole, and they were concerned that if the daughters who were going to get this land, if they start marrying outside their tribe, well, then this land that was originally going to be given to them was going to then be given to the tribe that they married into. So that was going to, you know, they'd be right back where they started. So they made a rule that said, no, you daughters, if you marry, you've got to marry within your tribe to make sure that their land stay within their tribe. So here we are now, 20 years later, these women approach Joshua again. Talk about persistent women, right, guys? You've got some experience with that? Joshua assures these women himself that they're going to get an inheritance. So, obviously, these women were eager and proactive in their desire for a land of their own. Joshua 17, 7 through 11, I'm not going to read it, but it describes the geography of West Manasseh over here. So just take a look, again, if I circle this East Manasseh, I circle that West Manasseh in relationship to everything that's been that's up there. You can see, and if you include Ephraim, you know, all the tribes of Joseph, it's a big allotment. It had a mixture of mountains and hills and valleys, and it was among the most fertile in all the promised land. So it was a big area, a big blessed area that they received in fulfillment of what was said earlier in the Old Testament. So we know that the people were eager of West Manasseh, and they were persistent when it came to receiving the land, but how did they fare? So here's verse 12 of Joshua 17. Yet the Manassites, we're talking about the west ones here, were not able to occupy these towns, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that region. However, when the Israelites grew stronger, they subjected the Canaanites to forced labor, but they didn't drive them out completely. So, I don't know, partial victory maybe? Is what you want to write there? We're all familiar, right, with we get new things, maybe it's one of these gifts, and how the luster wears off of new things pretty quickly. And maybe even something that one time you thought was a blessing or was really exciting soon becomes a burden to you. And the same thing is going to happen here with the tribes of Joseph. So soon after they receive their land, their attitudes take a negative turn. Look at verse 14 of Joshua chapter 17. The people of Joseph, so again we're talking about Ephraim and West Manasseh, said to Joshua, "Why have you only given us one allotment and one portion for an inheritance? We are a numerous people, and the Lord has blessed us abundantly." So think about what they said. Look at that map. Remember what I said about how good the land was that they were given? How valid was their complaint about receiving one allotment and it being too small? It seems kind of fishy to me. Doesn't it bother you when people misstate or misrepresent a situation in order to receive some kind of result for themselves? It's always a sign that the person is trying to cover up the truth. How much you want to bet that the real reason these people were asking for more land is because they couldn't drive out the Canaanites that were in the land that they had already been given, right? And it also seems from Scripture that the enemy was in the best parts of the land. So how do I get around that? Well, maybe if I ask for more land, you know, that'll be a way to solve that problem. But Joshua, the great leader he is, verse 15, he has a response to them. "If you are so numerous," Joshua answered, "and if the hill country of Ephraim is too small for you, go up into the forest and clear land for yourselves there in the land of the Perizzites and the Raphaites." So Joshua knew these people had resources to make improvements to the land that they'd already been given. So he challenged them to do so. You know, don't just stay where you're at. Go up into the land that you've been given and get to work. Get a job, maybe. But he was telling them. Here's the response of the people, verse 16. The people replied, "The hill country is not enough for us. And the Canaanites who live there in the plains have chariots filled with iron, both in Beth Shan and the settlements and those in the valley of Jezreel." So the people say, no. Even if we clear that hill country, it's still not going to be enough. Plus, in that flat land, you know, that, you know, we don't have to clear anything. In that area, the enemy's got chariots. It's going to be too difficult for us to take that over. When has it ever been important up until now for the Israelites to have been on equal military footing with the enemy in order to win? Has not, has it? They win their victories because of God being on their side. So, you know, whether they had chariots or not was irrelevant. Verse 17. Joshua said to the tribes of Joseph, "You are numerous and very powerful. You will not only have just the one allotment, but forested hill country as well. Clear it, and its farthest limits will be yours. Though the Canaanites have chariots fitted with iron, and though they are strong, you can drive them out." So he tells these people, get to work, clear the land, conquer the enemy, you're going to have plenty of places to live. There's no need to give them land above and beyond what they already have been given. Potentially, to do so, they'd have to take it from other tribes, right? And Joshua also knows that if he gives them more land, what does that mean? More enemies that they're going to have to conquer, right? So he puts the squash on that. So you look at the tribes of Ephraim and West Manasseh. They showed a desire to have land of their own, but they complained about what they had been given and lacked determination and faith to succeed. So we've gone through Judah, Ephraim, West Manasseh, Reuben, Gad, East Manasseh. Now all these tribes have actively requested their land in some way, or at least had it assigned to them, and they had taken some kind of action. But we've got some other tribes here that we haven't heard from yet. Benjamin, Simeon, Zebulun, Issachar, Asher, Naphtali, and Dan. So on your sheet, in the column it says their attitude. Whatever I say about the first of these remaining tribes will apply to the rest of them. So you can just draw a line and say, ditto, 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 right? Right on down from this point. So here's what happens. We get to Joshua 18. The whole assembly of the Israelites then gathered at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there. The country was brought under their control, but there were still seven Israelite tribes who had not yet received their inheritance. So what happens here is the Israelites move their base camp from Gilgal to Shiloh. I think it's a little bit...
Star of Shiloh,
thanks. Okay, so
Gilgal is just north
southwest
of Jericho.
Okay.
Not on that map, I don't think.
Yeah, so somewhere in here. So here's Jericho. So they move at 15 miles north or so, still in the land assigned to Ephraim. So it's here at Shiloh that God's divine presence resided in the tent of meeting or the sanctuary. So they make Shiloh their worship center, and it's the center of their civil court. So this is where everything's going on for the 12 tribes of Israel. In fact, it remains this religious and administrative center all the way up until the late 11th century. So in this new city of Shiloh, there's a sense of community, safety, and comfort. Here's what Joshua says to these remaining tribes at Shiloh. How long will you wait before you begin to take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your ancestors, has given you? Some scholars and commentators believe that the amount of time that they were here at Shiloh before Joshua said this to these people was anywhere from 1 to 7 years. So some significant amount of time goes by where those other tribes had received their allotment, but these people are just hanging around Shiloh. Kind of annoys Joshua, right? How long are you going to remain here? Being a good leader, he's trying to kick him in the pants. So what he does, he's going to gather together a group of people. He wants to force them into action. He's going to get a team together to scope out the remaining lands and figure out where these people are going to go. They got to survey the land and figure out 7 areas that would have enough good land and resources that these people could move into. So verse 4, here's what they do. Appoint 3 men from each tribe. I'm going to send them out, make a survey of the land. I'm going to write a description of it according to the inheritance, and they'll return back to me. You're going to divide the land into 7 parts. Judah is to remain in its territory in the south, which we already talked about. The tribes of Joseph are going to remain in their territory. But after you've written a description of the 7 parts of the land, bring them here to me. I'll cast lots in the presence of the Lord. A reminder here that the Levites don't actually get physical land because of their role in Israel. And a reminder, too, that Gad, Reuben, and half-tribe, they're not being considered here because they've already got what they requested on the east side. So, after these verses, what we learn is that Joshua criticized these tribes before the lands were even surveyed and determined. Before the lots were cast, Joshua criticized them. So this obviously reveals that these tribes all have a reluctant attitude. Reluctant. So that's where you can take the word reluctant and apply it to all these guys. Right down the list. So, verses 8 to 10, these surveyors, they take their journey. Joshua tells them, go make a survey of the land, write a description of it, return to me. Kind of repeats what was said earlier. Return back here to Shiloh. The men went and they, through the land, they wrote a description on a scroll, town by town. Here's the real advanced surveying techniques they used, right? They wrote its description on a scroll, town by town, in 7 parts, and then returned to Shiloh. Joshua cast the lots and he distributed the land. So the first lot that comes up after this occurs is for the tribe of Benjamin, and that brings us to Joshua 18, 11 through 28. Okay, so Benjamin tribe, their attitude is reluctance, right? You got that down? What kind of success did Benjamin have? I don't think it's mentioned in Joshua, but Judges tells us, Judges 1:21, but the sons of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have lived there with the sons of Benjamin up until the day that was occurring in Judges. So that brings us to Joshua 19. 6 tribes to go in Joshua. All right, so what we're going to learn in this chapter, it's interesting, is that some of the lands originally given to the proactive tribes, so the ones that had already received their land, so Ephraim and Judah, the description of their lands back in the earlier chapters, I'm going to just focus on Ephraim. The description of Ephraim, originally, they were here all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. So what's going to happen here is that some of the lands given to the proactive people are actually going to get taken from them and given to these slacker people. So, who just thought of the Back to the Future movie, right? The guy's a slacker. Anyways, I won't get off track. So what that tells me is when these surveyors went out to find 7 more pieces of land, they had a hard time finding, 7 pieces of great land to give to these 7 tribes. So Joshua decided, all right, then I'm going to have to take some of these other tribes' land and give it to the slackers so they have something, something that they can live in. So that's what's going to happen here. So what we see in this chapter in the allotment process, it's a combination of 2 things. So we got God's sovereign hand working, right, as far as whose tribe is going to come up in the lot assignment process, but you also got man working side by side in that situation. So man's going to be using his wisdom, his free will, and there are actually some activities and tasks that the man has, or that men have in this process. So both things are going on here simultaneously. Joshua 19, verses 1 through 9. Here's Simeon. We know about Simeon. He's a slacker. They are a slacker. Now, I couldn't find any direct statement about the performance of this tribe in Scripture. If you go to Judges 1, they do have some success fighting alongside Judah. But here's one of the cases where Joshua reconsidered the amount of land originally given to Judah, and he carves out a section for Simeon within Judah. Okay, so that hole right there, he goes and says, all right, I'm going to give you that, right out of the middle of what has been given to Judah before. Zebulun, slackers. Their success is noted in Joshua 1:20. Neither did Zebulun drive out the Canaanites living in Kitron or Nahal. So the Canaanites lived among them. Zebulun also, though, did subject them to forced labor. Issachar. Again, there's no direct statement of Scripture about their overall success, so I can't tell you, but I have a sneaking suspicion based upon what we're learning here. Asher is described in Joshua 19:24-31. Their success is noted in Joshua 31, or maybe their lack of success. Nor did Asher drive out those living in Echo or Sidon or Alab or a few other cities. The Asherites lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land because they could not drive them out. Joshua 19:32-39 is Naphtali. Naphtali, that's the way I wanted to say it. Their success is noted in Joshua 1:33. Neither did Naphtali drive out those living in Beth Shemesh or Beth Anath, but the Naphtalites too lived among the Canaanites of the land and those living in those cities, and they became forced laborers for them. So then we get to Dan, who are the last tribe to receive their inheritance. So we know about their attitude already. Their success is in Judges 1:34. The Amorites confined these people of Dan, the Danites, to the hill country, not allowing them to come down into the plain. So they were stuck up in the hill country. We also learn about their inability to be victorious in their land in Joshua 19:47. I think it was even mentioned after the service last week, the tribe of Dan, they're so unsuccessful. So get this. So first, they were given land taken out of Ephraim, and they become so unsuccessful here that they end up moving way up in this area to see if they can find somewhere easier to live. So at this point, all the lots have been cast. Everybody's received their land. And they've all displayed some amount of eagerness or hesitation or dissatisfaction with their land. Who haven't we talked about yet? The leader of the nation himself, Joshua, has received nothing yet. The last guy. Joshua 19:49. When they had finished dividing the land according to the allotment portions, the Israelites gave Joshua, son of Nun, an inheritance among them, as the Lord had commanded. They gave him the town that he asked for, Timnath-Serah, in the hill country. So Joshua waits patiently until everybody else has received their land, received their inheritance before he claims his own. So Joshua is willing to wait and to trust God to supply his portion. He doesn't feel the need to have to grab what is quote-unquote rightfully his before anybody else. I couldn't find any scriptural evidence that Joshua had actually been to this place that he was given. The spy trip route that Joshua was on, it describes a road, if you or a path that's a little bit off to the east of this. And I couldn't find any battles recorded in the city that he ended up in. Maybe the surveyors went through this land and they gave him some inside information. Or possibly Joshua had been there, because in fact the city lies in ruins, so maybe there was a battle there. So he knows about it in some way. He requested land or a city lying in ruins. He didn't ask for the biggest and best. He asked for a city lying in ruins. That's very interesting. So Joshua provides us with an example of somebody who did what he told other people to do, right? Go in, take possession, rebuild, settle in. And that's what he did. So Joshua obviously was somebody who is a good example of what we can follow when it comes to taking inheritance. So then we get to verse 51, and it basically wraps up the whole lot assignment process, and the land has been given. So what I find interesting is in Joshua 1 through 12, when these people are kind of all working together, right, victories, they're pretty much working in lockstep. They display strength and courage. They gain their foothold. God is faithful throughout this process. He gives them what they were promised. And then they receive a rest from war. However, after that, right, once the individual tribes are given their individual lands, their performance leaves much to be desired, doesn't it? Once they're required to embark on their own out in the real world, away from the safety and security of numbers, away from their base camp, things get tougher. And from here on in the Old Testament, you can see that they have a lot of problems amongst the tribes even. So, let's talk about ourselves now. What's our allotment? Where is our allotment? What is it? All right. We know that the Israelites, their allotment was right there in the Promised Land, a section of geography. Each section of land had different geographical characteristics, different ites. Every land had an ite people of some sort, right? Canaanite, Perizzite, Girgashite. What about us? First, as far as our allotment, we know God has promised us a home in heaven. That is so nice. The ultimate, perfect, everlasting promised land with Jesus. No battles to face, no struggles to occur there. And here we are on this earth just catching like these faint glimpses, right, of heaven. You know, you walk out and you see the sun on the horizon. Just all you can say is that's a glimpse of what heaven's going to be like. Wow. But here we are in this land longing for that place. 2 Corinthians 5, 1 through 10 is just a scripture that just talks about that. Man, we're just longing to get there. But until it happens, we're called to do some things here and now on this earth. And I think the way the Israelites responded and what they were called to do, there's some kind of direct correlation between what goes on in our life. We've been granted an allotment here in this earth as well. It's definitely not at Shiloh, right? Our allotment is not at our place of worship. The Bible never commands Christians to conquer the land within four square walls, does he? What does he say? Go into the world, right? Bring the gospel to the world. The Christian walk wasn't meant to be restricted to a land filled with smiling faces, pats on the back, the smell of coffee and cookies. Not that they're, you know, I like those, right? But the point is, that's not the land that we're supposed to be victorious in, and a land filled with great inspirational worship music. Go into the world and make disciples. You know, Jesus wasn't saying that we all individually have to go somewhere else, right? Because how chaotic that would be if everybody went somewhere else to bring the gospel. What he was saying is that the church was, you know, it was the church's responsibility to bring it to the earth. All the ends of the earth. There are plenty of places right here for us to, plenty of lands right around us, our neighborhoods, workplaces, and cities. What about our personal allotment, though? All right, so that's kind of the church as a whole, but you and me personally. We learned that each tribe had kind of their own individual characteristics or desires, right? Remember, we learned about the tribes on the east side of the Jordan. They were, I think, mostly farmers, and that was their desire. So they asked for that. So what I think is that whatever your current life situation is, that's your earthly allotment. So here, the geography of your land would include your relationships, your physical strengths, weaknesses, talents, gifts, good and bad circumstances. And the enemy in your land isn't any person or people group. Instead, we're involved in spiritual warfare, right? spiritual warfare that occurs in our soul, in our spirit, where specific places inside where issues and sins reside that do not want to be driven out either, right? Just like the people living in the Promised Land didn't want to be driven out. Let me give you some bullet points that I, you know, just brainstormed on how to take possession of your land. And again, thinking of how the tribes of Israel responded. First, seek to conquer the land God has given you, not the land you desire to have. So this would be represented by Reuben, Gad, and East Manasseh. Seek to conquer the land God has given you, not the land you desire. You know, we naturally view things from a short-term, ease of access, pleasure, convenience perspective, don't we? That's the first thing that comes to our mind. But as followers of Christ, that's not supposed to be our outlook. You know, we're not going to get exactly what we want. It's going to be hard. We're going to be attacked. There's going to be trial and error. Some of what you have been given might get taken away. If God has led you to a place of difficulty, don't shy away from it and settle for less. There is good that can come from needing to live in an imperfect land and battling against the enemy. Good can come from that. And if you're not currently battling against the enemy, get ready because it's coming. Right? John 16:33 is just a great verse. Take heart. Jesus says, I've overcome the world. Second bullet point, don't complain about the land you've been given. And this kind of is Ephraim and West Manasseh. Yes, we're going to have some level of disappointment. Some of us are going to look at those mountains and say, hey, that's beautiful. Right? Some people are going to look at those mountains, ooh, those are just tall obstacles. Some people are going to look at their land and think, I got way too many trees. I sure would like some more pasture. Right? God has our best interest at heart, so we can trust him. Do everything without grumbling or arguing. Third bullet point, accept your promised land with humility. So this, of course, is Joshua. He's our example here. Show humility when you receive your allotment. Trust God with what you've been given. If you think it from a ministry standpoint, don't make your ministry at the expense of others. Don't be jealous or regretful if you've got some type of a ministry and some of it is taken away and somebody else then like picks up on that ministry. You know, that's the way God's going to work. Don't resent that. It's a good place to be when you don't have to worry about being first. Just let God take care of the details. The Bible reminds us that God opposes the proud but shows favor to the humble. So humble yourselves before the Lord. He will lift you up. Root out the enemy, which is sin, that resides in your land. Because if you don't, it will rob you of peace, joy, and away from God. Hebrews 12:1-4 talks about throwing off the sin that hinders us and easily entangles us, run with perseverance the race marked out before us. Do not be discouraged, but be strong and courageous. Where have we heard that before, right? In this book? Don't be discouraged, be strong and courageous. Here again, this I think was represented by Caleb and Joshua in these chapters. There's always some type of work to be done or battle to face on this earth. We're all going to fail. Life isn't perfect. Don't let discouragement cause you to lose focus. Remember that God's power is made perfect in our weakness. So I had Lisa read some of the verses from the New Testament, Paul, because that's kind of the way he was. He was a motivating speaker and reminded us that having weakness is not a bad thing. Continued reliance on God's power brings victory. And then lastly, of course, live in expectation of ultimate victory in the perfect promised land that awaits us. Press on and take hold of that which Christ has taken hold of for us. So the Israelites were told to take hold of their land, and so are we. Take hold of the land that has been given you. And that's what Paul said too. I press on toward the goal to win the prize for which God has called me heavenward in Christ Jesus.